another with a half-naked brunette draped across a Camaro, a third and fourth showing concept cars with the ubiquitous big-bosomed model. Faith could still remember coming home from work one day to find his Bridges of the Southeastern United States posters replaced with these gems. Jeremy still thought that he'd cleverly tricked her into believing that puberty had brought on a sudden interest in automobiles.
"I'm in here."
She found him in her room. Jeremy was lying on his stomach, head at the foot of her bed, feet in the air, iPhone in his hands. The sound on the TV was muted, but the closed captioning was on. She asked, "Everything okay?" He tilted the iPhone in his hands, obviously playing a game.
"Yeah."
Faith remembered the fertile girlfriend. It was strange she wasn't here. They were usually attached at the hip. "Where's Kimberly?"
"We're taking a break,"
he said, and she almost sobbed with relief.
"I heard you and Zeke yelling."
"Well, there's a first time for everything." He tilted the phone the other way. She said, "I've been wanting one of those." He got the hint and put the device in his pocket. "I know you heard the phone ring. It was Will. He's working with Aunt Amanda." He stared at the TV.
"That's good."
Faith started to untie his sneakers. In typical teenage boy logic, he'd thought keeping his feet raised off the bed would stop debris from raining down. "Tell me what happened when Zeke got here."
"Dude was being an asshole."
"Tell me like I'm your mother." She saw him color slightly in the glow of the TV.
"Victor stayed with me. I told him he didn't have to, but he said he wanted to, so..."
Faith untied his other sneaker.
"You showed him Emma's picture?"
He kept staring at the set. Jeremy had really liked Victor, probably more than Faith had, which was only part of the problem. She told him,
"It's all right. Zeke was kind of shitty, I mean, rude, to him."
"In what way?"
"Just kind of poking his chest out and pushing him around."
"Just being Zeke." "Nothing happened, right?"
"Nah, Victor's not the type."
Faith assumed as much. Victor Martinez worked in an office, read the Wall Street Journal, wore bespoke suits, and washed his hands 16 times a day. He was about as passionate as a box of hair. It was Faith's lot in life that she would only ever be able to fall in love with the kind of man who would wear sleeveless t-shirts and punch her brother in the face. She slid off Jeremy's shoe, frowning at the state of his sock. "Toes go on the inside, college boy." She made a mental note to get him more socks when she ordered his underwear. His jeans were looking ratty, too. So much for the $300 left in her checking account. Thank God they had suspended her with pay. Faith was going to have to dip into savings just to keep her son from looking like a hobo. Jeremy rolled over onto his back to face her. "I showed Victor Emma's Easter picture." She swallowed. Victor was a smart man, but it didn't take a genius to do the math. Even without that, Faith was blonde and fair. Emma had her father's dark coloring and rich brown eyes.
"The one where she's wearing the bunny ears?"
He nodded.
"Well, that's a good one."
Faith could see the guilt well up in him like water spilling out of a glass. "It's all right, Jay. He would have found out eventually."
"Then why didn't you tell him?"
Because Faith was just the right mixture of emotionally stunted and controlling, which was something Jeremy would find out when his future wife screamed it in his face. For now, Faith said, "It's not something I'm going to talk to you about." He sat up to face her. "Grandma likes Will." Faith guessed he'd overheard her conversation with Zeke.
"She told you that?"
He nodded. "She said he was an all-right guy, that he treated her fairly and that he had a hard job to do, but he wasn't mean about it." Faith didn't know whether her mother had been assuaging Jeremy's concerns or revealing her true opinion. Knowing her mother, it was probably a mixture of both.
"Did she ever talk to you about why she retired?"
He tugged at a loose thread on the bedspread. "She said she was the boss, so it was her fault for not noticing what was going on." This was more than she'd ever told Faith.
Anything else?
He shook his head.
I'm glad Aunt Amanda has Will helping her. She can't do everything by herself. And he's really smart.
Faith stopped his hand and held it until Jeremy looked up at her. The television offered the only light in the room. It gave his face a green cast.
I know you're worried about Grandma. And I know there's nothing I can say to make this better for you.
Thanks. He was being sincere. Jeremy had always appreciated honesty. She pulled him up from the bed and wrapped her arms around him. His shoulders were thin. He was gangly. Not yet the man he was going to be, no matter the fact that he ate his weight in macaroni and cheese every day. He let her hug him for longer than usual. She kissed his head.
Everything's going to be all right.
That's what Grandmama always says.
And she's always right.
Faith squeezed him closer.
Mom, you're suffocating me.
Reluctantly, she let him go. Get some sheets for Uncle Zeke. He's going to sleep on the couch. Jeremy slid his feet back into his sneakers.
Has he always been that way?
Faith didn't pretend to miss his meaning. When we were little, every time he had to fart, he would run into my room and tear it loose. Jeremy started laughing. And then he said if I told on him, he'd gorge himself on beans and cheese and then hold me down and do it in my face the next time. That sent him over the edge. He bent over, holding his stomach as he brayed like a donkey.
Did he do it?
Faith nodded, which made him laugh even harder. She let him enjoy her humiliation a little longer before nudging him on the shoulder. Time to go to bed. He wiped tears from his eyes.
Man, I've got to do that to Horner.
Horner was his dorm mate. Faith doubted anyone would notice one more noxious odor in their shared quarters. Get Zeke a pillow from the closet. She pushed him out of the room. He was still laughing as he walked down the hallway. It was a small price to pay to see the worry momentarily absent from her son's face. Faith pulled back the comforter on her bed. Dirt from Jeremy's sneakers was smeared into the sheets. She was too tired to change the bed. She was too tired to put on her nightgown or even brush her teeth. She slipped off her shoes and got into bed wearing the same GBI rag she'd put on at 5 o'clock that morning. The house was quiet. Her body was so tense that she felt like she was lying on a board. Emma's soft snores came through on the baby monitor. Faith stared up at the ceiling. She'd forgotten to turn off the television. Light flashed like a strobe from the action movie Jeremy had been watching. Boyd Spivey was dead. It seemed impossible to grasp. He was a big guy, larger than life, the sort of cop you imagined going out in a blaze of glory. He was the exact opposite of his partner. Chuck Fenn was dour, full of gloomy predictions, and terrified that he would be shot in the line of duty. His defense during the investigation was the only one Faith had found credible during the whole mess. Chuck had claimed he was just following orders. To those who knew him, it seemed entirely plausible. Detective Finn was the quintessential follower, which was exactly the personality type that men like Boyd Spivey knew how to exploit. But Faith didn't want to think about Boyd or Chuck or any of her mother's team right now. The investigation had eaten up 6 months of her life. 6 months of sleepless nights. 6 months of worrying that her mother was going to have a heart attack or end up in prison or both. Faith made herself close her eyes. She wanted to think of good times with her mother, to recall some moment of kindness or summon the pleasure of her company. What she saw instead was the man in her mother's bedroom. The black hole in the center of his forehead where Faith had shot him. His hands jerked up. The hostage stared at Faith in disbelief. His mouth gaped open. She saw the silver grill on his teeth, that his tongue was pierced with a matching silver ball. Almeja, he had said. Money. Faith heard the floorboards creak in the hall. Jeremy? She pushed herself up on her elbow and turned on the bedside lamp. He gave her a sheepish look. Sorry, I know you're tired. Do you want me to take the sheets down to Zeke?
No, it's not that. He pulled his iPhone out of his pocket. Something came up on my Facebook page.
I thought you stopped using that when I made you friend me.
Faith had never been the kind of parent to completely trust her kid. Her own parents had trusted her, and look where that had gotten them.
What's going on?
His thumbs moved across the screen as he talked.
I got bored. I mean, not bored, but there was nothing to do, so...
It's okay, baby. She sat up in bed.
What is it?
Lots of people have been posting stuff. I guess they heard about Grandma on the news.
That's nice, Faith said, though she found it a bit ghoulish and, to borrow a word from her brother, dramatic.
What are they saying?
Mostly just that they're thinking about me and stuff like that. But there's this.
He turned the phone around and handed it to her.
Faith read the message aloud. Hey, Jaybird, hope you're okay. I'm sure the bad guys will get fingered. Just remember what your grandma used to say. Keep your mouth shut and your eyes open.
Faith checked the screen name.
Good night, 92.
Is that someone you went to Grady with?
Jeremy's high school mascot was the Knight, and he had been born in 1992.
He shrugged.
Never heard of him.
Faith noted that the post had come in at 2:32 that afternoon, less than an hour after Evelyn had been abducted. She tried not to sound concerned when she asked, "When did he friend you?"
"Today, but a lot of people did. They kind of all came out of the woodwork."
She gave him the phone.
"What does his profile say?"
"Just that he lives in Atlanta and works in distribution." He thumbed through the screen and showed it to Faith.
Her eyes were so tired that she had trouble focusing.
Faith held the phone close to her face so she could read the words. There was nothing more, not even a picture. Jeremy was Goodnight's only friend. Faith felt her cop's intuition telling her something was wrong, but she handed back the phone as if it was nothing.
"I'm sure it's someone you went to Morningside with. You were teased so bad about Grandma calling you Jaybird that you begged me to let you switch to another school."
"It's weird, though, right?"
She wasn't going to let him worry.
"Most of your friends are weird."
He wouldn't be soothed.
"How does he know that about Gran always saying that?"
"It's a pretty common saying," Faith answered.
"Mouth shut, eyes open. I had a drill instructor at the academy who practically tattooed it on his forehead."
She forced a lightness into her tone.
"Come on, it's nothing. It's probably a cop's kid. You know the rule. Something bad happens and we're all family."
That finally seemed to mollify him. Jeremy had been dragged to his share of hospitals and strangers' homes when a police officer had been wounded or killed. He put the phone back into his pocket.
She asked, "You sure you're okay?"
He nodded.
"You can sleep in here if you want."
"That'd be weird, Mom."
"Wake me if you need me."
Faith lay back down, slipping her hand under the pillow.
Her fingers touched something wet.
Familiar.
Jeremy immediately picked up on the change.
"What's wrong?"
Faith's breath was trapped in her chest. She didn't trust herself to speak.
"Mom?"
"Tired," she managed.
"I'm just tired."
Her lungs ached for oxygen. She felt sweat break out all over her body.
"Get the sheets before Zeke comes up here."
"Are you?
It's been a long day, Jeremy. I need to go to sleep."
He was still reluctant.
"All right."
"Can you shut my door?"
She wasn't sure she could move even if she wanted to.
Jeremy gave her another worried look as he pulled the door closed. Faith heard the click of the latch, then the soft padding of his feet as he walked down the hall to the laundry room. It was only when she heard the third stair from the bottom squeak that Faith allowed herself to pull her hand out from under the pillow. She opened her clenched fist. The sharp pain of fear receded, and now all Faith could feel was blinding fury. The message on Jeremy's iPhone. His high school. His birth year. Keep your mouth shut and your eyes open. Her son had lain in this bed, his feet inches from what she had found. "I'm sure the bad guys will get fingered." The words only made sense when Faith held her mother's severed finger in her hand.
Chapter 6 Sarah Linton was no stranger to self-loathing. She'd felt ashamed when her father saw her steal a candy bar from the honor box at church. She'd felt humiliated when she caught her husband cheating on her. She'd felt guilty when she lied to her sister about liking her brother-in-law. She'd felt embarrassed when her mother pointed out that she was too tall to wear capri pants. What she'd never felt like was trashy, and the knowledge that she was no better than a reality TV star cut her to the core of her being. Even now, hours later, Sarah's face still burned at the thought of her confrontation with Angie Trent. There was only one other time in her life that she could recall a woman talking to her the way Angie had. Jeffrey's mother was a mean drunk, and Sarah had caught her on a very bad night. The only difference in this instance was that Angie had absolutely every right to label Sarah a whore. Jezebel, Sarah's mother would have said. Not that Sarah was going to tell her mother about any of this. She muted the television, the sound grating on her nerves. She'd tried reading. She'd tried cleaning up her apartment. She'd clipped the dog's toenails. She'd washed dishes and folded clothes that were so wrinkled from being piled on her couch for so long that she'd had to iron them before they would fit in the drawers. Twice she'd headed toward the elevator to take Will's car back to his house. Twice she'd turned back around. The problem was his keys. She couldn't leave them in the car, and she sure as hell wasn't going to knock on the front door and hand them to Angie. Leaving them in his mailbox was not an option. Will's neighborhood wasn't bad, but he lived in the middle of a major metropolitan city. The car would be gone in the time it took Sarah to walk back home. So she just kept assigning herself busy work, all the while dreading Will's arrival like a root canal. What would she say to him when he finally came to get his car? Words failed, though Sarah had silently rehearsed plenty of speeches about honor and morality. The voice in her head had taken on the cadence of a Baptist preacher. This was all so sordid. It wasn't right. Sarah was not going to be some tawdry other woman. She wasn't going to steal someone's husband, even if he was ripe for the taking. Nor was she going to engage in a catfight with Angie Trent. Most of all, she wasn't going to step into the middle of their incredibly dysfunctional relationship. What kind of monster bragged about her husband trying to kill himself? It made Sarah's stomach turn. And then there was the larger issue. To what depths had Will sunk where slicing a razor up his arm seemed like the only solution? How obsessed was he with Angie that he would do such a terrible thing? And how sick was Angie that she'd held him while he did it? These questions were best handled by a psychiatrist. Will's childhood obviously had not been a walk in the park. That fact alone could cause some damage. His dyslexia was an issue, but it didn't seem to stop his life. He had his quirks, but they were endearing, not off-putting. Had he worked through his suicidal tendencies, or was he just good at hiding them? If he was past that point in his life, why was he still with that horrible woman? And since Sarah had decided nothing was going to happen between them, why was she still wasting her time thinking about these things? He wasn't even her type. Will was nothing like Jeffrey. There was none of her husband's staggering self-confidence on display. Despite his height, Will wasn't a physically intimidating man. Jeffrey had been a football player. He knew how to lead a team. Will was a loner, content to blend into the background and do his job under the shadow of Amanda's thumb. He didn't want glory or recognition. Not that Jeffrey had been an attention seeker, but he was incredibly secure in who he was and what he wanted. Women had swooned in his presence. He knew how to do just about everything the right way, which was one of the many reasons Sarah had thrown logic to the wind and married him. Twice. Maybe she wasn't really interested in Will Trent at all. Maybe Angie Trent was partly right. Sarah had liked being married to a cop,
but not for the kinky reasons Angie had implied. The black-and-white nature of law enforcement appealed to Sarah on a deep level. Her parents had raised her to help people, and you couldn't get much more helpful than being a police officer. There was also a part of her brain that was drawn to the puzzle-solving aspects of a criminal investigation. She had loved talking to Jeffrey about his cases. Working in the morgue as the county coroner, finding clues, giving him information that she knew would help him with his job, had made her feel useful. Sarah groaned, as if being a doctor wasn't a useful thing. Maybe Angie Trent was right about the perversion. Next, Sarah would start trying to imagine Will in a uniform. She shifted her two greyhounds off her lap so that she could stand. Billy yawned. Bob rolled onto his back to get more comfortable. She glanced around her apartment. An antsiness took over. She felt overwhelmed by the desire to change something, anything, so that she felt more in control of her life. She started with the couches, sighting them at an angle from the television while the dogs looked down at the floor passing underneath them. The coffee table was too big for the new arrangement, so she shifted everything again, only to find that that didn't work either. By the time she finished rolling up the rug and muscling everything back into its original place, she was sweating. There was dust on the top of the picture frame over the console table. Sarah got the furniture polish out and started dusting again. There was a lot of space to cover. The building she lived in was a converted milk processing factory. Red brick walls supported 20-foot ceilings. All the mechanical workings were exposed. The interior doors were distressed wood with barn door hardware. It was the sort of industrial loft you expected to find in New York City, though Sarah had paid considerably less than the $10 million such a place would fetch in Manhattan. No one thought the space suited her, which was what had drawn Sarah to the apartment in the first place. When she'd first moved to Atlanta, she'd wanted something completely different from her homey bungalow back home. She was thinking lately that she'd gone overboard. The open plan felt almost cavernous. The kitchen, with its stainless steel everything and black granite tops, had been very expensive and very useless to someone like Sarah, who had been known to burn soup. All the furniture was too modern. The dining room table, carved from a single piece of wood and large enough to seat 12, was a ridiculous luxury considering she only used it to sort mail and hold the pizza box while she paid the delivery guy. Sarah put away the furniture polish. Dust wasn't the problem. She should move. She should find a small house in one of the more settled Atlanta neighborhoods and get rid of the low-lying leather couches and glass coffee tables. She should have fluffy couches and wide chairs you could snuggle into for reading. She should have a kitchen with a farmhouse sink and a cheery view to the backyard through the wide open windows. She should live somewhere like Will's house. The television caught her eye. The logo for the evening news scrolled onto the screen. A serious-looking reporter stood in front of the Georgia Diagnostic and Classification Prison. Most insiders referred to it as the DNC, fully mindful of the play on words for Georgia's death row. Sarah had seen the story of the two murdered men earlier and thought then what she thought now. Here was yet another reason not to be involved with Will Trent. He was working on Evelyn Mitchell's case. He had probably been nowhere near that prison today. But the minute Sarah saw the story about a murdered officer, her heart had jumped into her throat. Even after they'd given the man's name, as well as that of the dead inmate, her heart would not calm. Thanks to Jeffrey, Sarah knew how it felt when the phone unexpectedly rang in the middle of the night. She remembered how every news story, every snippet of gossip caused something inside of her to clench in fear that he would be going out on another case, putting his life in danger. It was a form of post-traumatic stress disorder. Sarah hadn't realized until her husband was gone that she'd been living in dread for all those years. The intercom buzzed. Billy gave a half-hearted growl, but neither dog got off the couch. Sarah pressed the speaker button. "Yes?" Will said, "Hi, I'm sorry, I..." Sarah buzzed him in. She grabbed his keys off the counter and propped open the front door. She wouldn't invite him in. She wouldn't let him apologize for what Angie had said because Angie Trent had every right to speak her mind. And what's more, she'd made some very good points. Sarah would just tell Will that it was nice knowing him and good luck working things out with his wife. If he ever got here. The elevator was taking its sweet time. She watched the digital readout show the car moving from the fourth floor down to the lobby. It took another forever for the numbers to start ascending. She whispered them aloud. 3, 4, 5. And then finally the bell dinged for 6. The doors slid back. Will peered out behind a pyramid of 2 cardboard file boxes, a white styrofoam carton, and a Krispy Kreme donut bag. The greyhounds, who only seemed to notice Sarah around supper time, ran out into the hall to greet him. Sarah mumbled a curse. Sorry I'm so late. He turned his body so that Bob wouldn't knock him over. Sarah grabbed both dogs by their collars, holding the door open with her foot so that Will could come in. He slid the boxes onto her dining room table and immediately started petting the dogs. They licked him like a long-lost friend, their tails wagging, nails scratching against the wood floor. Sarah's resolve, which had been so strong only seconds before, started to crack. Will looked up. Were you in bed? She had dressed appropriately for her mood in an old pair of sweatpants and a Grant County Rebels football jersey. Her hair was pulled back so tightly that she could feel it tugging the skin on her neck. Here are your keys. Thanks. Will brushed the dog hair off his chest. He was still wearing the same black t-shirt from that afternoon. Whoa. He pulled back Bob, who was making a play for the Krispy Kremes. Is that blood? There was a dark, dried stain on the right-hand sleeve of his shirt. Instinctively, Sarah reached for his arm. Will took a step back. It's nothing. He pulled down the cuff. There was an incident at the prison today. Sarah got that familiar, tight feeling in her chest. You were there. I couldn't do anything to help him. Maybe you. His words trailed off. The staff doctor said it was a mortal wound. There was a lot of blood. He clamped his hand around his wrist. I should have changed shirts when I got home, but I've got a lot of work to do, and my house is kind of upside down right now. He had been home. Without reason, Sarah had let herself think for just a moment that he hadn't seen his wife. We should talk about what happened. He seemed to purposefully miss her point. Not much to say. He's dead. He wasn't a particularly good guy, but I'm sure it'll be hard on his family. Sarah stared at him. There was no guile on his face. Maybe Angie hadn't told Will about the confrontation. Or maybe she had, and Will was doing his best to ignore it. Either way, he was hiding something. But suddenly, after spending the last few hours working herself into a frenzy, Sarah didn't care. She didn't want to talk about it. She didn't want to analyze it. The only thing she was certain of was that she did not want him to leave. She asked, "What's in the boxes?" He seemed to note her shift in attitude, but chose not to acknowledge it. Case files from an old investigation. It might have something to do with Evelyn's disappearance. Not kidnapping? His grin indicated he'd been caught. I just have to know everything in these files by 5 tomorrow morning.
Do you need help?
Nope. He turned to lift the boxes. Thanks for getting Betty home for me.
Being dyslexic is not a character flaw.
Will left the boxes on the table and turned around. He didn't respond immediately. He just looked at her in a way that made Sarah wish that she had bothered to bathe. Finally, he said, I think I liked it better when you were mad at me. Sarah didn't respond. It's Angie, right? That's what you're upset about?
These shifting levels of subterfuge were new to her. It seems like we were ignoring that.
Would you like to continue along that path?
Sarah shrugged. She didn't know what she wanted. The right thing to do would be to tell him that their innocent flirtation was over. She should open the door and make him leave. She should call Dr. Dale tomorrow morning and ask him out on another date. She should forget about Will and let time erase him from her memory.
but it wasn't her memory that was the problem. It was that tightness in her chest when she thought about him being in danger. It was that feeling of relief when he walked through the door. It was the happiness she felt just from being near him. He said, "Angie and I haven't been together, in over a year." Will paused as if to let that sink in. "Not since I met you." All Sarah could say was, "Oh." And then, when her mother died a few months ago, I saw her for maybe 2 hours, and she was gone. She didn't even go to the funeral. He paused again. This was obviously difficult for him. "It's hard to explain our relationship. Not without making myself look pitiful and stupid. You don't owe me an explanation." He put his hands in his pockets and leaned against the table. The overhead light caught the jagged scar above his mouth. The skin was pink, a fine line tracing the ridge between his upper lip and nose. Sarah couldn't begin to calculate the amount of time she'd wasted wondering how the scar would feel against her own mouth. Too much time. Will cleared his throat. He looked down at the floor, then back up at her. "You know where I grew up. How I grew up." She nodded. The Atlanta Children's Home had closed many years ago, but the abandoned building was less than 5 miles from where they stood. "Kids went away a lot. They were trying to get more of us into foster care. I guess it's cheaper that way." He shrugged as if this was to be expected. "The older ones didn't usually work out. They lasted maybe a few weeks, sometimes only a couple of days. They came back different. I guess you can imagine why." Sarah shook her head. She didn't want to. There wasn't exactly a long line of people who wanted to foster an 8-year-old boy who couldn't pass the 3rd grade. But Angie's a girl, and pretty, and smart, so she got sent out a lot. Again, he shrugged. "I guess I got used to waiting for her to come back. And I guess I got used to not asking what happened while she was gone." He pushed away from the table and picked up the boxes. "So, that's it. Pitiful and stupid." "No, Will." He stopped in front of the door, the boxes held in front of him like a suit of armor. "Amanda wanted me to ask you if you know anyone at the Fulton ME's office." Sarah's brain took its time changing gears. "Probably. I did some of my training there when I started." He shifted his grip. "This is from Amanda, not me. She wants you to make some calls. You don't have to, but what does she want to know?" "Anything that comes up on the autopsies. They're not going to share with us. They want to keep this case." He was turned toward the door, waiting. She looked at the back of his neck, the fine hairs at the nape. "All right. You've got Amanda's number. Just call her if anything comes up, or call her if it doesn't. She's impatient." He stood waiting for her to open the door. Sarah had spent most of the day wanting him out of her life. But now that he was leaving, she couldn't take it. Amanda was wrong. He turned back around to face her. "What she said today? Amanda was wrong." He feigned shock. "I don't think I've ever heard anyone say those words out loud before." "Almeja, the dying man's last words?" She explained. "The literal translation is right, clams, but it's not slang for money. At least not the way I've heard it used." "What's it slang for?" She hated the word, but she said it anyway. "Cunt." His brow furrowed. "How do you know that?" "I work in a large public hospital. I don't think a week's gone by since I started without someone calling me some variation of that word." Will dropped the boxes back on the table. "Who called you that?" She shook her head. He looked ready to take on her entire patient roster. "The point is, the guy was calling Faith that name. He wasn't talking about money." Will crossed his arms. He was obviously riled. "Ricardo," he supplied. "The guy in the backyard who shot at those little girls, his name was Ricardo." Sarah held his gaze. Will kept talking. Hironobu Kwan was the dead guy in the laundry room. We don't know anything about the older Asian except that he had a fondness for Hawaiian shirts and spoke with a Southside Southern drawl. And then there's someone else who got injured, probably in a knife fight with Evelyn. You'll probably see the notice at the hospital when you go back to work. Blood type B negative, possibly Hispanic, stab wound to the gut, possibly a wound on his hand. That's quite a cast of characters. Trust me, it's not easy keeping up with them. And I'm not even sure any of them are the real reason all of this is happening.
What do you mean?
This feels personal. Like there's something else at play. You don't wait around 4 years to rob somebody. It's got to be about something more than money. They say it's the root of all evil for a reason. Sarah's husband had always loved money motivations. In her experience, he tended to be right. This injured guy, the one with the gut wound, is he in a gang? Will nodded. They generally have their own doctors. They're not bad. I've seen some of their handiwork at the ER. But a belly wound is pretty sophisticated to treat. They might need blood, and B negative is hard to come by. They'd also need a sterile operating environment, medicines that you can't just grab at your local drugstore. They'd only be at a hospital pharmacy.
Can you give me a list? I can have it added to the alert.
Of course. She went to the kitchen to find a pad and paper. He stayed by the dining room table.
How long could someone live with a stab wound in their belly? It bled a lot at the scene.
It depends. Hours, maybe days. Triage can buy some time, but anything close to a week would be a miracle.
You mind if I eat my dinner while you do that?
He opened the styrofoam box. She saw 2-foot-long hot dogs soaked in chili. He sniffed, then frowned.
I guess the guy at the gas station was going to throw them out for a reason.
Still, he picked up one of the hot dogs.
Don't you dare. It's probably fine.
Sit down. She took out a frying pan from the cabinet and found a carton of eggs in the refrigerator. Will sat at the bar across from the stainless steel cooktop. The styrofoam box was on the counter beside him. Bob poked it with his nose, then backed away. She asked, "Was that really your dinner? 2 hot dogs and a Krispy Kreme donut?"
4 donuts.
What does your cholesterol look like?
I guess it's white, like they show in the commercials.
Very funny. She wrapped the styrofoam container in aluminum foil and threw it in the trash. Why do you think Faith's mother wasn't kidnapped?
I didn't actually say that. I just think a lot of things aren't adding up.
He watched Sarah break eggs into a bowl.
I don't think she left willingly. She wouldn't do that to her family, but I think she might know her kidnappers. Like, they had a previous working relationship.
How? He stood and walked to the dining room table, where he took out a handful of yellow folders from one of the boxes. He grabbed the bag of donuts before sitting back down at the kitchen bar.
Boyd Spivey, he said, opening the top file and showing her a mugshot.
Sarah recognized the face and name from the news.
That's the man who was killed at the prison today.
Will nodded, opening the next file.
Ben Humphrey.
Another cop?
Yep.
He opened another file. There was a yellow star stickered on the inside.
This is Adam Hopkins. He was Humphrey's partner.
Another file, this one with a purple star.
This is Chuck Finn, Spivey's partner, and this guy...
He fumbled open the last file. Green star.
Is DeMarcus Alexander.
He'd forgotten one. Will went back to the table and found another yellow folder. This one had a black star, which seemed prophetic when he said,
Lloyd Crittenden died from a drug overdose 3 years ago.
All cops? Will nodded as he shoved half a donut into his mouth. Sarah poured the eggs into the pan. What am I missing?
Their boss was Evelyn Mitchell.
Sarah almost spilled the eggs. Faith's mother? She went back to the photographs, studying the men's faces. They all had that same arrogant tilt to their chins, as if their present trouble was just a blip on the radar. She skimmed Spivey's arrest report, trying to decipher the typos. Theft during the commission of a felony. She flipped back the page and read the details. Spivey issued a standing order to his team that they should remove 10% off the top of every drug bust involving cash money exceeding $2,000.
It added up.
To how much?
From what accounting could estimate, over the course of 12 years, they stole around $6 million.
She gave a low whistle.
That's a little less than $1 million each, tax-free. Or at least it was. I'm sure Uncle Sam caught up with them their first day in prison.
Even stolen money was taxable income. Most inmates got their notice from the IRS within the first week of their prison sentence. Sarah checked the front page of the arrest report, stopping on a familiar name.
You were the investigating officer.
It's not my favorite part of the job. He shoved the rest of the donut into his mouth. Sarah looked down at the file, pretending to read on. The typos hadn't been much of a red flag. Every police report she'd ever read was riddled with grammar and spelling mistakes. Like most dyslexics, Will treated spell check as sacrosanct. He'd substituted words that made no contextual sense, then signed his name at the bottom. Sarah studied his signature. It was little more than a squiggle running at an angle from the black line. Will was watching her closely. She realized she needed to ask a question.
Who instigated the investigation?
An anonymous tip came into the GBI.
Why wasn't Evelyn charged?
The prosecutor refused to bring a case. She was allowed to retire with her full pension. They called it early retirement, but she was way past her 30 years. She wasn't working for the money. At least, not the money she was getting from the city.
Sarah used a spatula to stir the eggs. Will ate another donut in two bites. The powdered sugar sprinkled onto the black granite countertop. She said, "Can I ask you something?"
"Sure."
"How does Faith work with you after you investigated her mother?"
"She thinks I'm wrong."
Bob was back. He propped his nose on the counter, and Will started petting his head.
"I know that she cleared it with her mother, but we've never really talked about it beyond that."
Sarah would not have believed anyone else telling her the same thing, but she could easily imagine how this worked. Faith wasn't one to sit around talking about her feelings, and Will was just so damn decent that it was hard to assign him vengeful ulterior motives.
"What's Evelyn like?"
"She's old school."
"Like Amanda?"
"Not exactly."
He took another donut out of the bag.
"I mean, she's tough, but she's not as intense."
Sarah understood what he meant. That generation didn't have a lot of avenues for proving themselves to their male counterparts. Amanda had taken the ball-breaking route with obvious relish.
"They came up together," Will told her. "They went to the academy together, then worked joint task forces through APD and the GBI. They're still good friends. I think Amanda dated Evelyn's brother or her brother-in-law."
Sarah couldn't think of a more obvious conflict of interest. "And Amanda was your senior officer when you were investigating Evelyn?"
"Yep."
He inhaled another donut.
"Did you know this at the time?"
He shook his head, keeping the donut in his cheek like a squirrel with a nut so that he could ask,
"You know the stove isn't on, right?"
"Crap." That explained why the eggs were still liquid. She clicked the dial until the flame whooshed up. He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
"I like to let them sit for a while, too. Gives them a woodsy character."
"That's E. coli." She checked the toaster, wondering why it hadn't popped up. "Probably because there was nothing in there." Will smiled as she got a loaf of bread out of the cabinet. She said, "I'm not much of a cook."
"Do you want me to take over?"
"I want you to tell me about Evelyn." He leaned back in the chair.
"I liked her when I met her. I know that seems strange under the circumstances. I guess I was supposed to hate her, but you can't look at it that way. This is government work. Sometimes investigations get started for the wrong reason, and you find yourself sitting opposite somebody who's been jammed up for saying the wrong thing or ticking off the wrong politician."
He brushed the powdered sugar into a pile as he talked.
"Evelyn was very polite, respectful. Her record was spotless until then. She treated me like I was just doing my job, not like I was a pedophile, which is what you normally get."
"Maybe she knew she'd never be prosecuted."
"I think she was worried about it, but her primary concern was her daughter.
She worked really hard to keep Faith out of it. I never even met her until Amanda paired us up.
She's a good mother, at least.
She's a classy lady. But she's also smart, strong, tough. I wouldn't bet against her on this.
Sarah had forgotten the eggs. She used the spatula to scrape them off the bottom of the pan. Will told her Evelyn was duct-taped to a chair while they searched her house. I found an arrowhead drawn underneath the seat. She used her own blood to do it.
Where was it pointing?
Into the room? At the couch? Into the backyard? He shrugged.
Who knows? We didn't find anything.
Sarah thought about it. Just the head of an arrow? That's all? He fanned out the powdered sugar again and drew the shape. Sarah studied the symbol, silently debating how to proceed. She finally decided the truth was her only option.
It looks like a V to me.
The letter V. He was quiet in a way that changed the air in the room. She thought he was going to change the subject or make a joke, but he told her,
"It wasn't perfect. It was smudged at the top."
"Like this?" She drew another line. "Like the letter A?" He stared at the figure.
"I guess Amanda wasn't pretending when she said she didn't know what I was talking about."
"She saw it too." He brushed the powdered sugar into his hand and dropped it into the bag with the last donut.
"Yep."
She put the plate of eggs in front of him. The toaster popped up. The bread was almost black.
"Oh, no," she mumbled.
"I'm so sorry. You don't have to eat this. Do you want me to get the hot dogs out of the trash?" He took the burned toast from her and dropped it on the plate. It made a sound like a brick scraping concrete.
"Some butter would be nice."
She had fake butter. Will dipped a knifeful out of the tub and coated the bread until it was soggy enough to fold in his hand. The eggs were closer to taupe than yellow, but he started in on them anyway. Sarah told him, "The name Amanda starts with an A. Almeja starts with an A, and now Evelyn might have drawn an A on the bottom of her chair." He put down the fork. His plate was clean. She continued, "Almeja sort of sounds like Amanda. The same number of syllables, the same first and last letter." He would have missed the alliterative. Most dyslexics couldn't rhyme two words if you put a gun to their heads. He edged his plate away.
"Amanda isn't telling me everything. She's not even admitting that the corruption case has anything to do with Evelyn's situation."
"But she told you to go over all your case files."
"Either she needs the information or she's trying to keep me busy. She knows this will take me all night."
"Not if I help you." He picked up his plate and walked over to the sink.
"Do you want me to wash this before I go?"
"I want you to tell me about the crime scene." He rinsed his plate, then started to wash his hands. "That's the cold," Sarah said, and then because it was pointless to tell him that because she was left-handed, she'd switched the hot water valve to the right-hand side. She leaned in and adjusted the temperature for him. Will opened his hand so that she could squirt some soap onto his palm.
"Why do you smell like lemon furniture polish?"
"Why did you let me believe Betty belongs to your wife?" He lathered the soap in his hands.
"There are some mysteries that will never be solved."
She smiled. "Tell me about the crime scene." Will told her what they had found. The upturned chairs and broken baby toys. He segued into Mrs. Levy and Evelyn's gentleman caller. Mittal's theory about the blood trail and Will's own divergent theory about the same. By the time he got to the part where they had found the gentleman in the trunk, Sarah had managed to get him to sit down at the dining room table. She asked, "Do you think Boyd Spivey was killed because he talked to Amanda?"
"It's possible, but not likely."
He explained, "Think about the timing. Amanda called the warden 2 hours before we got to the prison. The prison doc said a serrated knife was used. That's not something you can make out of your toothbrush. The camera was disabled the day before, which indicates this was planned at least 24 hours in advance."
"So it was coordinated.
Evelyn is taken. Boyd is killed a few hours later. Are the other men from her team safe?"
"That's a very good question."
He pulled his cell phone out of his pocket.
"Do you mind if I make some calls?" Of course not. She got up from the table to give him some privacy. The frying pan was still warm, so she ran cold water over it. The eggs were seared to the metal. She picked at the slime with her thumbnail before giving up and sticking it on the top rack of the dishwasher. Sarah opened Boyd Spivey's file again. Will had used a pink star to identify him, perhaps as a joke. The man looked the part of a corrupt cop. His moon-shaped face indicated steroid use. His pupils were barely discernible in his beady eyes. His height and weight were closer to a linebacker's. She skimmed the details of Spivey's arrest while listening with half an ear as Will talked with someone at Valdosta State Prison. They discussed whether or not to move Ben Humphrey and Adam Hopkins into solitary confinement, and agreed that it would be best just to step up their monitoring. Will's next call was more complicated. Sarah assumed he was talking to someone at GBI headquarters about locating the remaining two men through their parole officers. She opened Spivey's file and found his personnel record behind the arrest report. Sarah read through the details of the man's professional life. Spivey had joined the academy fresh out of high school. He'd gone to night school at Georgia State in order to earn a BA in criminal science. He had three children and a wife who worked as a secretary at the Dutch consulate on the outskirts of the city. Spivey's promotion onto Evelyn's team was a coup. The drug squad was one of the most elite in the country. They had all the best weapons and facilities and enough high-profile bad guys in the Atlanta area to win them plenty of commendations and press time, which Spivey in particular seemed to enjoy. Will had collected newspaper clippings on the team's most noteworthy busts. Spivey was front and center of every news story, even though Evelyn was the leader of the team. One photo showed a clean-shaven Spivey with enough ribbons on his chest to decorate a girl's bicycle. And still it had not been enough. Hey. Sarah looked up from her reading. Will had finished his phone calls. Sorry about that. I wanted to make sure they were safe.
It's fine.
Sarah wasn't going to pretend she hadn't been listening.
You didn't call Amanda?
No, I didn't.
Give me some more files to read.
You really don't have to do this.
I want to.
Sarah was no longer being kind or trying to spend more time in his company. She wanted to know what had made a man like Boyd Spivey turn into such a lowlife.
Will stared at her long enough to make her think he was going to say no.
Then he opened one of the boxes. There was an ancient Walkman nestled in a pile of audio cassette tapes. None of them had labels, unless you counted the colored star-shaped stickers. Will explained, "These are recordings of all the interviews I had with each suspect. None of them said much in the beginning, but they all ended up making deals to cut time off their sentences."
They ratted each other out?
Not a chance. They had some information on a couple of local councilmen to trade. It gave them some leverage with the prosecutor. Sarah couldn't pretend to be shocked over politicians with drug problems.
How much leverage?
Enough to get them talking. Not enough to make them give up the big fish.
He opened the next box and started pulling out files. As with everything else, they were color-coded.
He handed her the green ones first. Witness testimony for the prosecution. He stacked the red ones, which were fewer in number. Witnesses for the defense. He took out the blue ones. High-dollar busts. Anything where more than $2,000 was seized.
Sarah went right to work, carefully reading the next personnel file. Ben Humphrey had been the same kind of cop as Boyd Spivey, solidly built, good at his job, driven to get press, and in the end, absolutely corrupt. The same proved to be true of Adam Hopkins and DeMarcus Alexander, both of whom were praised for their bravery under fire during a bank robbery, both of whom paid cash for their vacation homes in Florida. Lloyd Crittenden had earned his shield after flipping his cruiser six times during the pursuit of a man who'd shot up a seedy bar with a sawed-off shotgun. He also had a mouth on him. There were two write-ups for insubordination, but Evelyn's yearly reviews had been nothing if not glowing. The only outlier was Chuck Finn, who seemed more cerebral than his colleagues. Finn had been in the process of earning his PhD in Italian Renaissance art when he was busted. His lifestyle wasn't as lavish as the others.
He used his ill-gotten gains to educate himself and travel the world. He must have complimented the team in more subtle ways. Evelyn Mitchell had obviously handpicked each man for a reason. Some were leaders. Some, like Chuck Finn, were obviously followers. They all fit the same general profile. Overachievers with a reputation in the department for doing whatever had to be done. Three were white, two were black. One was part Cherokee Indian. All of them had given up everything for cold, hard cash. Will flipped over the tape in the Walkman. He sat with his eyes closed, headphones tucked into his ears. She could hear the squeak of the wheels working in the tape player. The next stack of folders detailed all of the high-dollar busts the team had made and presumably skimmed from over the years. Sarah had thought these files would be the hardest to get through, but they all turned out to be fairly mundane. Such was the nature of the illegal drug trade that most of the men the team had arrested were either dead or incarcerated when Evelyn's squad was busted. Only a few were still on the street, but they were obviously active. Sarah recognized some of the names from the nightly news. Two looked promising for their own reasons. She set their files aside for Will. Sarah checked the time. It was well past midnight, and she had an early shift in the morning. As if on cue, her mouth opened in such a wide yawn that her jaw popped. She glanced at Will to make sure he hadn't seen. There was still a large stack of folders in front of her. She was only halfway through. But she couldn't make herself stop if she wanted to. It was like trying to put together all the clues in a mystery novel. The good guys were just as corrupt as the villains. The villains seemed to take the graft as a cost of doing business. Both probably had a long list of justifications for their illegal actions. She tackled the next pile of folders. The six men on Evelyn's team had never gone to trial, but they must have been close to starting when the deals were made. The prosecution's list of potential witnesses had been highly screened, but no more so than those representing the defendants. The names would be familiar to Will, but still, Sarah carefully read through each file. After a solid hour of comparing statements, she let herself move on to the last file, which she'd held back as a reward for not giving up. Evelyn Mitchell's booking photo showed a trim woman with an unreadable expression on her face. She must have felt humiliated to be booked and processed after spending so much time on the other side of the table. Nothing about her expression gave that away. Her mouth was set in a tight line. Her eyes stared blankly ahead. Her hair was blonde like Faith's, with gray streaking through at the temples. Blue eyes, 138 pounds, 5'9", a little taller than her daughter. Her career was the sort that garnered pioneer awards from the local women's club, which Captain Mitchell had twice received. Her promotion to detective was preceded by a hostage negotiation that had resulted in the freeing of two children and the death of a serial child molester. Her lieutenant rank came almost 10 years after passing the test, with the highest grade yet recorded. Her captainship was the result of a gender bias lawsuit filed with the EEOC. Evelyn had worked her way up the hard way, paying her dues on the street. She had 2 degrees, one from Georgia Tech, both with honors. She was a mother, a grandmother, a widow. Her children were in what Sarah thought of as service, one to her community, the other to his country. Her husband had worked a solidly respectable job as an insurance salesman. In many ways, she reminded Sarah of her own mother. Kathy Linton wasn't the sort of woman to carry a gun, but she was driven to do what she believed was right for herself and her family. But she would have never taken a bribe. Kathy was painfully honest, the sort of person who would turn around and drive 50 miles back to a tourist trap in Florida because they had given her too much change. Maybe this explained why Faith could work with Will. If someone had told Sarah that her mother had stolen almost $1 million, she would have laughed in their face. It was the stuff of fairy tales. Faith didn't just think he was wrong about her mother. She thought he was deluded. Will changed out another tape. Sarah motioned for him to take off his headphones. It doesn't add up.
What doesn't?
You said each team member netted just shy of $1 million. You've accounted for $60,000 at best in the out-of-state account that was open in Bill Mitchell's name. Evelyn doesn't drive a Porsche. She doesn't have a mistress. Faith and her brother weren't in private schools, and the only vacations she took were to Jekyll Island with her grandson.
It adds up after today, he reminded her.
Whoever took Evelyn wants that money.
I don't buy it.
Most cops defended their cases like they would defend their children. Will just asked,
why?
Gut feeling?
Instinct?
I just don't buy it.
Faith doesn't know about the bank account.
I won't tell her. He sat up, clasping his hands together. I've been listening to my early interviews with Evelyn. She talks about her husband, mostly.
Bill, right? He was an insurance agent.
He died a few years before the case was brought against Evelyn.
Sarah braced herself for a widow question, but Will went in another direction.
The year before Bill died, he was sued by the family of a policyholder for a claim denial. They said Bill filled out some paperwork incorrectly. A father of three had a rare kind of heart defect. The company denied treatment.
This wasn't a new story to Sarah.
They said it was a pre-existing condition.
Only it wasn't, at least not diagnosed. The family got a lawyer, but it was too late. The guy ended up dying because the wrong box was checked on a form. 3 days later, his widow gets a letter in the mail from the insurance company saying that Bill Mitchell, the originating agent, made a mistake on the forms and her husband's treatment was approved.
That's awful.
Bill took it hard. He was a very careful man. His reputation was important to him, important to his work. He got an ulcer worrying about it.
That wasn't technically how ulcers worked, but she told him, go on.
He was eventually cleared. They found the original forms. The insurance company had screwed up, not Bill. Some data entry person had clicked the wrong box. No malfeasance, just incompetence.
Will waved this away.
Anyway, what Evelyn said was that Bill never got past it. It made her crazy because he wouldn't let it go. They argued about it. She thought he was just feeling sorry for himself. She accused him of being paranoid. He said people at work treated him differently. A lot of people thought the company took the bullet, and it was really Bill's mistake.
Sarah was dubious.
An insurance company took the bullet.
People get crazy ideas, Will said.
Anyway, Bill felt like it wiped out all the good he'd done over the years. Evelyn said that when the cancer came, Bill died of pancreatic cancer 3 months after his diagnosis, she thought part of the reason he couldn't fight it was that he had this guilt hanging over his head, and that she had never forgiven him for that, for not fighting the cancer. He just kind of accepted it and then waited to die.
Pancreatic cancer was not easily vanquished. The chances for long-term survival were less than 5%.
Stress like that can certainly impair your immune system.
Evelyn was worried the same thing was going to happen to her.
That she'd get cancer?
No, that the investigation would ruin her life, even if she was cleared. That it would hang over her head forever. She said that in all the years since her husband had died, she had never wanted him back more than she did that day, so she could tell him that she finally understood.
Sarah considered the weight of the statement.
That sounds like something an innocent person would say.
It does.
Does that mean you're leaning away from your original conclusion?
It's very kind of you to phrase your question so diplomatically.
He grinned.
I don't know. My case was shut down before I could wrap it up to my satisfaction. Evelyn signed her papers and took her retirement. Amanda didn't even tell me it was over. I heard it on the news one morning. Decorated officer retiring from the force to spend more time with her family.
You think she got away with it?
I keep coming back to one thing. She was in charge of a team that stole a whole lot of money. Either she turned a blind eye, or she's not as good as she reads on paper.
Will picked at the plastic seam on one of the audio tapes.
And there's still the bank account. It might not seem like much compared to millions, but $60,000 is a chunk of change.
And it's in her husband's name, not hers. Why not change it over now that he's dead? Why still keep it a secret? All good points.
He was quiet for a moment. The only sound in the room, his thumbnail picking at the plastic seam.
Faith didn't call me when it happened. I didn't have my cell, so it would have been pointless, but she didn't call me.
He paused.
I thought maybe she didn't trust me because it was her mother involved.
I doubt she was even thinking about that. You know how your brain just blanks out when something like that happens?
Did you ask her about it?
She's got a lot more on her mind right now than holding my hand.
He gave a self-deprecating chuckle.
Maybe I should write about it in my diary.
He started packing up the boxes.
Anyway, I'll let you get to bed.
Did you find anything I should know about?
Sarah pulled out the two files she'd set aside. These guys might deserve a closer look. They were in the high-dollar busts. One of them was also on Spivey's defense witness list. I flagged him because he has a history of kidnapping for leverage over rival gangs.
Will opened the top file. Sarah supplied the name. Ignacio Ortiz.
Will groaned. He's in Phillips State Prison on a manslaughter attempt.
So it won't be hard to find him.
He runs Los Texicanos.
Sarah was familiar with the gang. She had treated her share of kids who were involved in the organization. Not many of them walked out of the ER in one piece.
Will said, if Ortiz is wrapped up in this, he'll never talk to us. If he's not, then he'll never talk to us. Whichever it is, driving to the prison would be 3 or 4 hours out of our day for nothing.
He was going to be called as a witness for Spivey's defense. Boyd had a surprising number of thugs willing to testify that he hadn't touched their money. There was a whole roster of criminals willing to stand up for Evelyn's team.
Did you get anything from Boyd at the prison?
Will frowned. Amanda interviewed him. They talked in some kind of code. One thing I picked up on was that Boyd said the Asians were trying to cut the Mexicans out of the supply side.
Los Texicanos, Sarah provided.
Amanda told me their preferred method is slitting throats.
Sarah put her hand to her neck, trying not to shudder.
You think that Evelyn was still doing business with these drug dealers?
He closed Ortiz's file.
I can't see how. She doesn't have any juice without her badge, and I can't picture her as a kingpin unless she's some kind of sociopath. Granny nanny by day, drug lord by night.
You said Ortiz is in prison for attempted manslaughter.
Who'd he try to kill?
His brother. He found him in bed with his wife.
Maybe this is the brother.
Sarah opened the next file. Hector Ortiz, she told him. He's not a bad guy on paper, but he made the defense witness list. I pulled him because he has the same last name as Ignacio.
Will unclipped the mugshot from the file to get a closer look.
Is your gut still telling you that Evelyn is innocent?
Sarah looked at her watch. She had to be at work in 5 hours.
My gut has turned in for the night.
What is it?
He held up Hector Ortiz's photograph. The man was bald with a salt-and-pepper goatee. His shirt was rumpled. He held up his arm to show a tattoo to the camera. A green and red Texas star with a rattlesnake wrapped around it.
Will said, "Meet Evelyn's gentleman friend." Sunday. Chapter 7. The open-handed slaps had turned into punches hours ago. Days ago,